Okay, welcome, everyone. It's April 13th, 2015. This is the Senate Committee on the Workforce. And today we are devoting our afternoon to the subject of minimum wage. And this is a topic that has been in the works for, you know, since before the beginning of the session. I want to thank everyone for their patience in waiting for it to come onto the agenda. But today we're devoting our entire day to the issue of minimum wage. And we're also going to have hearings this evening that will be open to the public on the subject of minimum wage. This afternoon's hearing is all invited testimony. We will be hearing from a couple of senators who have introduced legislation about minimum wage. And then we'll be having panels, alternating panels of proponents and opponents. And we'll try to keep each panel to about 15 minutes, if possible. Some of them have more people on them, so you're going to have to be a little shorter than the ones that have fewer people on them. Before we get started, so I'm going to call up actually the first panel. We have some electeds, Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Bates, and Mayor Oberst from Monmouth, if you could come up. And while you're coming up, I'm going to have Matt Germer, our administrator, give us a rundown on the bills that we're talking about, because there are at least a half dozen of them. We have proposals that are calling for different levels of increase for the minimum wage, and we have a couple of bills that are looking at removing the state preemption on minimum wage. Oregon is a state where whatever we do with the minimum wage, it has to be statewide. So cities could not on their own implement an ordinance that would have a higher minimum wage. Whatever we do, it has to be statewide. And there is some interest in some people's minds that we should remove that preemption and let the cities go their own way. And I think we'll be hearing pros and cons on that, as we will with all of these issues. This issue of minimum wage is a key part of what's come to be called the fair shot agenda, the notion that people who are doing important work that is compensated at the lower levels of the wage scales need to be able to work and earn enough to live without resorting to government support. That's kind of the notion behind it. So the question is, how do you do that in a way that allows businesses to continue and not be harmed to the point that they have to go out of business? So that you'll hear a lot of that, I think, during this hearing and in tonight's hearing. So quickly, Matt, if you could tell us what we're dealing with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have six bills that we will be discussing today. Two of them are related to statewide preemption of minimum wage. The first is Senate Bill 130, which would repeal the preemption of charter and statutory authority of local governments to set minimum wage requirements, declares an emergency effective on passage. The other is Senate Bill 332, which repeals the preemption of charter and statutory authority of local governments to set minimum wage requirements, declares an emergency effective on passage. We then have four bills directed toward what the minimum wage should be. The first is Senate Bill 327, which raises the minimum wage to $12.20 by 2017 and requires the minimum wage to be above the hourly equivalent of federal poverty guidelines for a family of four as determined by the United States Department of Health and Human Services, declares an emergency effective on passage. Senate Bill 597 raises the minimum wage to $13.50 by 2017, declares an emergency effective on passage. Senate Bill 610 raises the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2018, declares an emergency effective on passage. And Senate Bill 682 raises the minimum wage to $10.75 by 2016.
Okay, thank you very much, Matt. So I'm going to officially open this informational meeting on these bills. And we'll start with Senator Rosenbaum, because committee members always go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And for the record, my name is Diane Rosenbaum. I'm the senator from District 21, which is Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. And I'm very pleased today to appear on this side of the dais and be able to kick off what is, I think, a very important hearing in the Capitol on the subject of minimum wage. And I think others will talk more specifically about the bills as we go forward. So I would just like to set the stage and give you a little background. And I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the history of the minimum wage in Oregon, which is a long and proud history. In fact, if you go back to the early part of the 20th century, you will find that there was a young woman named Carolyn Gleason who went to work in the sweatshops in downtown Portland and was so appalled by the conditions that she found there. She was somewhat working undercover, experiencing the conditions herself, that she came to the Capitol and worked to pass the very first minimum wage law in the country. It applied to women at the time. But that law became the model for the National Fair Labor Standards Act. So I think you can fairly say that Oregon did have the first minimum wage law in the country and led the nation and became a model for later laws. That woman, Carolyn Gleason, later became Sister Miriam Teresa. She was a nun in the Order of Holy Child and went on to head the sociology department at Merrillhurst College. My own history with the minimum wage does not go back quite that far, but it does go back some 25 years. In fact, I think the first time I came to the Capitol was as in 1989 as part of a coalition trying to raise the minimum wage. And in fact, that year, the legislature did vote to raise the minimum wage. And in fact, that 25-year-ago vote was the last time that there was a vote of this legislature to raise the minimum wage. There have been votes on aspects of this since, but not a vote that actually resulted in an increase. So we do have a long and proud history. After that, because there were many failed attempts to get votes on bills, I was able to be part of a coalition in 1996 that resulted in an initiative that we placed on the ballot, and voters agreed to raise the minimum wage. And then in 2002, I was the chief petitioner of a subsequent initiative that actually raised our minimum wage in three stages and put our current cost of living increase, annual increase, into the law. So I had been part of both of those efforts. But now, colleagues, although I'm proud of that history, I think it is time to revisit the law that we have and see how it's working for Oregonians. Because as it currently stands, our minimum wage is by no means adequate. Hardworking Oregonians who make this minimum wage, largely they're women, people of color, immigrants, and families, simply don't earn enough to make ends meet. And as our economy improves, and we're glad to see that, we're also seeing rent hikes and other costs going up. But a huge group of Oregonians who are workers are not seeing the results of that renewed prosperity. And it's becoming harder and harder for these Oregon workers to simply afford to live in Oregon. I think Oregon is on a destructive path driven by low-wage, no-benefit jobs that aren't working for our families and are dragging our entire economy down. An Oregon worker earning minimum wage at a full-time job today takes home just $19,240 a year. That's not nearly enough to afford housing, food, gas, and the other necessities for one person, let alone for a family, and forget about saving for the future, something everybody would like to do, but for these folks, it's not even within the realm of possibility. Putting more cash in Oregon minimum wage employees' pockets will boost spending and stimulate our entire economy. We have over 400,000 workers in Oregon who are living paycheck to paycheck on the current minimum wage, unable to support basic necessities and falling below the poverty line. So as our economy begins to recover from the depths of the recession, these Oregonians are being left behind. We must fight for these workers who are struggling to get by. The evidence shows that raising the minimum wage will bring the bottom up for everyone. No one here is interested in putting an unfair burden on Oregon's small businesses. And according to a study that I'm sure you'll hear more about today that was released last week by the Oregon Center for Public Policy, past increases in the minimum wage have not hampered job growth or small business growth. In fact, these increases in wages have been shown to increase worker productivity and lower turnover. The economic benefits of increasing the minimum wage to our economy, to commerce, and to families are clearly documented. My colleagues, we can't afford to push this issue off any longer. The stakes are simply too high. 25 years is a very long time for the legislature to go without voting to raise our minimum wage. I'm glad that we're starting this discussion today. I look forward to hearing from others and from the workers themselves about what this would mean. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for convening this hearing. It's an honor to be part of it.
Thank you, Senator. Doc Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thanks for taking the time to have this hearing, and looking forward to joining tonight at 6 o'clock for your open hearing also. This has been a 30-year march for me, not just the minimum wage. I want to talk about it a little broader than that to start with. It's really a march against poverty. I grew up in poverty, and I've had a practice in medical practice in an area of poverty for a long time. So many of my patients have been struggling for years with poverty, and we've made some big changes in healthcare that have helped them a lot lately. But other than that, they still are struggling and are not really getting where they need to get to. For 30 years, we've had a national and state policy that basically said to people in very simple terms, you're better off staying home, raising a couple kids, not working, and getting benefits from the state or the federal government. Many people might disagree with that, but in fact, if you look at it, that's essentially what we've told many people. We have an opportunity with the economy improving, and with things changing the way they are in Oregon, with the Affordable Care Act and other issues, that we can break that mold, stop some of this generational poverty and dependence on government programs. I know I'm sounding like a Republican. Bear with me here. Okay. There is a real need to do this, and the key to it is going to be probably moving the minimum wage up to break that generational poverty that we have to deal with all the time. I have two handouts for you. The first one I don't want you to look at right now. Look when you have a chance. It's a compilation that was prepared for the city of Seattle about a year ago about why you should raise the minimum wage. They looked at five or six studies, put them all together. It's very reasonable. It's 27 pages long. If you can't stand the 27 pages, go to the conclusion at the end. It basically tells you that there's no significant impact on jobs if you raise the minimum wage in a thoughtful manner, and that's what Seattle's trying to do. It's not a simple $15 an hour tomorrow. It's done over 3 to 7 years. There's a lot of gives and takes in it for different businesses. So if you have a chance, I'd like to have you read that. I think that takes one of the arguments away against minimum wage. What I really want to speak to you more about is human services and Oregon Health Plan and its effect on these people as far as discussion of minimum wage is concerned. As many of you know, for the last 15 years, I've either been on or chaired the committee that takes care of DHS and OHA. We are now at a $22 to $24 billion biannual budget on this. Huge amount of money going into these programs to help people stay out of poverty and have a reasonable way of living. Raising the minimum wage is important for two things. One, it will probably start driving down our caseloads, which are eating our budgets alive. You already know we went through with K-12 and what we raised them to around 9.5%, and the budget's increasing by around 10 to 11% at most. DHS is going to be going up to 11 to 12% increase. That is unsustainable if we don't do something to change it, and this is part of that change. We have to bring caseloads down in our welfare system. Minimum wage helps us do that. It also does something for the people involved in it. when you go to work every day, and you work 30 or 40 hours a week, and you get up every morning and go to work, you start developing what we call soft skills. These are the skills of responsibility and sense of self-worth. And that may not sound like much to some people, but it's really important to get people back in the workforce. Getting up every day, getting your kids off to school, and have a sense of worth because you've got a job that's paying you enough that you can actually get by on. You can't do that at $9 an hour with a couple of kids. The second handout you'll see here is the Oregon Benefits Cliff. I think you've got it in front of you by now. It shows you what happens if we don't do this very, very carefully. The programs we have to support people are very complex and don't match very well. We have four or five major programs. One is called TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. That pays a stipend every month to individuals who are extremely low in poverty. That allows them basically to get some rent paid so they can have a place to stay and not be living under the bridge. We have a second program called ERDC, which is employment-related daycare, where we subsidize what people pay to have their children taken care of and hopefully good daycare. The third thing we have is SNAP, which is a program from the federal government, which is used to be called food stamps. I think you're all aware of that. And then we have another program, which is the Earned Income Tax Credit. These all intermingle with each other at different levels of poverty and different issues going on in each one of them. And bringing them together in one place and trying to present them to people in an understandable fashion is really tricky. LFO has done a great job, especially Laura Byers, in putting this together and giving us a first really good picture of it. What you'll see in front of you is the Oregon Benefits Cliff, and if you look behind it, the actual numbers. We picked one adult, two kids working 40 hours a week at different hourly wages. Understand that some people won't be working 30 hours a week. And if you walk through this, you'll see between 9-10 an hour and 12-10 an hour, total benefit is about the same. The cliff starts just past $12 an hour, and it's a dramatic cliff. And when you step off ERDC or you step off TANF or you step off SNAP, it's kind of like stepping off your back porch and missing a step. When you step off the Oregon Health Plan, you just dropped into the Grand Canyon and you are dead. That's the biggest change we have to avoid. If you raise minimum wage too high and people drop off Medicaid, the cost of health care to them is unsupportable. Not only, we didn't even put in this, by the way, what it would cost from the point of view of deductibles and co-pays. All this shows is what they lose as far as actual payments as premium is concerned. It's actually a bigger cliff than this shows. It's huge. So one of the things we have to keep in mind as we have this discussion is we don't drop people off Medicaid. In fact, if you wanted to drop them off Medicaid, you're probably looking at a minimum wage of around $20 to make up the difference. I don't think we're ready to go to $20 an hour this afternoon here. But we can make a substantial change and still keep people covered with OHP and not hurt them. The big difference, if you look at this too, you'll see the blue marks coming up. That's income. That's working. You'll see that the tax credits go back down and the total benefit package from the state starts going down. This drives them off many of our rolls. Taking people out of Medicaid has another ripple effect on our economy you need to think about also. The Medicaid match with the federal government is roughly 2 to 3 to 1. For every dollar we put up, they put up $2 to $3. If Oregon by itself disenrolled a large number of people out of Medicaid, we'd lose $8 to $10 billion out of our economy. We can't afford to do that. If every state in the union did it, it would be all right. But if we selectively do that, it's gonna really hit our economy hard. Hospitals, doctors, nurses, outpatient clinics, and the rest. So it's important that you keep in mind, if you would please, that Medicaid is not to be touched. I guess in summation, I would tell you the most important thing to me is that I start moving in a direction of getting people away from depending on government to make a living and to really become self-sufficient. In the last 8 years, we chose not to do that. Because of the recession, we didn't feel there were jobs out there. It was hard to do it, and we bolstered these programs as much as we could to keep people off, you know, physically off the streets. They have a place to live. They have food. Kids could go to school. With the situation changing economically in the country and in the state, it's time to move forward and reinforce that change. I would love to see TANF rolls drop by 20 or 30%. I'd love to see ERDC go down. I'd like to see SNAP go down because people would have real jobs, making real money, becoming self-sufficient permanently. I'll add one last piece. I think these people also, many of them, need an opportunity that's not part of this discussion right now. Most of these families are single women with a couple children. And these ladies have a very low education level. What they need is an opportunity to get a meaningful education at community college. We've estimated for $10 to $15 million that we can cover their tuition along with Pell Grants, get them into college, get them through job programs, real job programs to help them get jobs where they won't need the minimum wage. They'll be well above it. So I'd like to have that as part of the conversation, but it's not part of the purview, I understand, of this committee. But it's part of the entire package we're trying to put together to move people in the right direction. And I'll get off my soapbox and be quiet for you. I guess I'd also add that I'd love to see the legislature get paid a minimum wage, because right now we're about $4 an hour, the way I figure it.
Thank you very much, Senator. Yeah. I will say that the educational component of workforce development is part of the interest of this committee, and I'm very sympathetic to those comments. Mayor Oberst, welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. John Oberst, I'm the mayor in Monmouth and also a member of the League of Oregon Cities Board. I'm not sure exactly what the minimum wage should be. I have a better idea of what it should be in Monmouth than I have in Portland or Eugene or Roseburg. And I'd like to speak to the notion that it's time to remove the preemption on minimum wage that our cities currently face. It was 100 years ago that the voters in Oregon created home rule for cities. Every city in Oregon is a home rule city. No voters have ever seen fit to undo that. And part of that is because they recognize that it's folks at the local level who have the best sense of what needs to happen at the local level. There are cases where it's really important to have statewide control. I like the fact that every city in Oregon has to be audited every year. That's a really good idea. I think statewide ethics rules are a good idea. The list goes on and on. On the minimum wage, different cities have different requirements for a standard of living that will lift people out of poverty. It's a lot cheaper, surprisingly, to live in rural areas than it is in urban areas. And I can give you a specific example of the difference in cost of living. Corvallis is about 20 miles south of Monmouth, and this is a 25-year-old story now, but we had a builder come through and build a large swath of houses in Monmouth and build exactly the same houses in Corvallis. And the same house in Corvallis cost $25,000 more, and that was a substantial amount of money 20 years ago, than the cost in Monmouth. That's why we wound up with a lot of Hewlett-Packard employees living in Monmouth. That carries across transportation, housing, food, different costs for different cities to reach that level that's above the poverty level. And I would urge the committee to entertain the notion that perhaps cities should be allowed to set their own minimum wage if it is, in fact, above the level, the minimum level set by the state. I don't want to see cities go below that minimum. It's probably time for the state to address a higher minimum, but I certainly would encourage allowing cities to set their own standard higher than that state level if, in fact, the elected officials see fit to do that. They will doubtless work closely with their citizens and business community before they would take that step. Those of us at the local level know that unpopular items are referred in a heartbeat. So, and that's nothing anybody really wants to go through to pass legislation and see it thrown out. So, again, just allow the cities to look at this themselves.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Questions, colleagues, of any of the panel members? I do have a question for you, Dr. Bates.
Yes.
I think you raise a very serious issue with the benefits cliff. We need to think about the size of the minimum wage in connection to that. But are there things that we can do with the benefits themselves? I mean, are there things that we control that could help to smooth out that challenge?
Yeah, the limits on Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, are set by the federal government. We have no control over that. Okay, so we can't change that. In ERDC and in TANF, we can. There are choices we have that we can make. Some of that is block grant money. We have to maintain an effort in it of a certain amount of general fund dollars, but not completely. We can smooth out what we do in TANF at the end as people come off TANF. A big part of that is what you just mentioned, and I mentioned also with education. EDRDC is a great deal of that as our purvey of what we want to do as far as how much we pay for benefits and what the income levels are we can affect on. So we have some choices there to make. We would love to make those choices with this committee so we can work in concert with you, because that would be part of our budgeting process over the next 3 to 4 weeks. And I would look forward to coming back and talking to you again and presenting you possibilities of what we might or might not do. Our committee is a joint committee of both House and Senate. We have some people working very diligently in the House on ERDC and TANF benefits. We're meeting next week to have a joint meeting with these people and really try to figure out what the best way to handle this is. Our goal is to bring caseloads down, minimum wage up, get people off caseloads, get them out on their own. And I think we can do some work on that. Thank you for your question.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, all three of you. All right, our next panel is Rob Sisk, Casiel Capriel, Ashley Bardalis, and Jan Elfers, please. Can we get another chair up there? We'll have four on a couple of these panels. Okay, thank you. Whoever wants to go first, just start off by telling us your name.
Okay, I'll get started. Good afternoon. My name is Ashley Bardalis. Chair Dembrow, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak today. I am a single mother to two children and have 11 years of experience in the service industry. I have never made more than a dollar over minimum wage, despite my attempts to move up in a company. Over the last 11 years, I have attempted higher education 7 different times. Each attempt was crushed by my necessity to work more hours to afford bills. My children and I currently live with my parents. I'm attempting school for cosmetology. This would seem like an excellent way out of poverty wages. Unfortunately, after 2 years of schooling, I will likely have to work as a licensed cosmetologist earning minimum wage. My story is not uncommon, but that doesn't make it okay. Many Oregonians like myself are trying to provide for a family. People say we need to work hard to get out of poverty wages. I will ask you this. If every one of us gets a degree and moves out of the service industry, who will make you your coffee? Who will ring up your purchases when you make a trip to the grocery store? Who will serve you when you enjoy a meal out with your family? Who will fill up your gas tank? And most importantly, who will cut your hair? Whether you're stopping in for a cup of coffee or getting gas in your vehicle, you're making purchases daily. Service workers help society run one lunch, one cup of coffee, 1 gallon of milk, and 1 full tank of gas at a time. So why are we valuable members of society expected to suffer in poverty? No Oregonian should work 40 hours a week and not be able to afford to pay their bills. With 10% of our population earning minimum wage, neglecting this bill is neglecting the people. The committee has an opportunity to make a ripple effect in our economy right now by giving the bottom tier wage earners a $15 wage. A society is only as strong as their weakest. I've been asked what $15 an hour would mean to my children and I. It would mean I could be self-sufficient. I wouldn't need food stamps to provide food for myself and my children. $15 an hour would bring me to be able to afford an apartment for us to live on our own. I would be independently able to provide for my children. It's the difference between paying the rent and an eviction notice. Even at $10 an hour, I was 120 pounds because I couldn't afford to feed myself as well as my children. The first 3 years of my daughter's life, I saw her only a few hours a week as I tried to work hard enough to keep us afloat. $15 would mean being able to raise my children myself, to keep us afloat, to be healthy and fed and just thrive a little bit. I don't need cable or internet. I don't own a vehicle, and I'm okay with that. But I would like to enjoy life with my children. I would like to live to work to live, not live to work. $15 an hour would mean being able to actually live. Chair Dembrow and members of the committee, you can do something to prevent stories like mine from being possible in our great state. Please act swiftly to pass a minimum wage of $15 an hour for me and my children and thousands of struggling families just like mine across this great state that just can't afford to wait.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bardalis. Next.
Hello. Thank you for this opportunity to share my story. My name is Cassiel Capriel. I moved from the Federated States of Micronesia to America 8 years ago in search of a better life. When I arrived in Portland, I dreamed of finding a job, settling down, and providing my children with a good education. I was able to get a job at Portland International Airport, where I still work as a passenger service agent. My job at the PDX involves helping passengers in wheelchair get around the airport, wherever folks need to go. The ticket counter, car rental, departure gate, or the coffee shop, I'm there to help them. Even with all of the effort, when I started my job at the airport, the pay was minimum wage after 8 years. I am still working for minimum wage. Now it's $9.25 an hour. Every day I give all of my effort at my job, but there is no path toward getting a raise or any type of benefits. Even with all of the efforts that I put into my job, I still struggle. I'm a single mother, and it is difficult to balance the needs of my kids with full-time job. Because I am Micronesian, I cannot access to public health insurance in the United States. Even though I have been here working for the same company for 8 years, the insurance my employer provided is too expensive for me. In the last 2 years, my rent has gone up 3 times. Last month, it went up by $100. Every month, I have to pay $75 extra to my landlord so I can pay half of my rent each paycheck. I'm a single mother. I live near the airport with my children. I like our apartment, and I don't want to move, but I don't know how I'll be able to keep up with rent. At the end of last year, my hours were cut from 40 to 32. Now it's even harder to pay rent on time. If we raise the minimum wage, I will be able to take home money each paycheck, money I could use to pay my rent on time and save for my children's education. Most importantly, I will feel like I was treated with respect for the work I do. When I came to the U.S., I didn't think it would be like this. Now I just hold on to the only job that I know. Now I just work hard and try to show my value. The dreams I haven't worked out, I just work to survive. I will be better if we made fair wage. Right now, the Oregon legislature is considering raising the state's minimum wage. It's time they take action to support Oregon's working families. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Capriel. Jan, welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, right. We'll get it a little closer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jan Elfers, and I am the Public Policy Director at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, or EMO. EMO is a statewide association of religious denominations, congregations, and community-based cooperative ministries. We represent hundreds of Oregonians in every rural and urban community throughout the state. Our testimony today emanates from our shared religious values, which affirm the value and dignity of every human being and the responsibility of a just society to help create opportunities for its citizens to thrive. We urge you to support raising the minimum wage in order to enable hardworking Oregonians to better provide for themselves and for their families. EMO is committed to promoting both the welfare of children and the overall health and economic stability of families and communities. Today, a worker earning minimum wage at a full-time job does not make enough money to afford housing, food, gas, and other necessities for a family. Many of these low-wage workers must depend upon government benefits. Systematic low-wage work means the demand for public services is at a record high, and our ministries reflect this. For example, over 1 million Oregonians now rely on SNAP or food stamps or other assistance to feed their families. Valuing workers for the services they provide is an important step towards economic justice. When people work full time, they should be able to meet the basic needs of life. The legislation before you is supported by leaders in business, in the faith, labor, and other community organizations. These leaders realize that with over 400,000 Oregonians employed in low-wage jobs, this segment of the labor force makes up an increasing share of Oregon's economy. The growth of income inequality in our nation needs to be addressed, and raising the minimum wage is the quickest and most effective way to deal with this disparity. Raising the minimum wage honors the many low-wage workers who are often immigrants, women, elders, youth, and people of color. They include mothers and fathers who are forced to work erratic schedules and non-standard shifts, making parenting responsibilities even more difficult. As a religious organization, we are called to act in solidarity with those living on the margins. Justice requires us to establish social and economic systems that encourage, enable, and empower all people to develop and use their capabilities to meet their needs and to contribute to the social welfare. Raising the minimum wage is a minimal step in establishing such a system. Oregon's economy needs to work for all Oregonians, not just a few. We urge you to raise the minimum wage and give every Oregonian a fair chance for a hopeful future. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan. Rob.
Chair Dumbrough and committee members, I am Rob Sisk, president of SEIU 503 OPEU. And SEIU 503 represents over 55,000 workers throughout Oregon across a variety of sectors, including state government, higher education, local governments, nonprofits, nursing homes, as well as care providers. I'd like to deviate a little bit from my written script just to tell you that I'm very close to this issue because for years I struggled as a low-wage worker. Even when I came to work as a groundskeeper for the state, which is the job I left to come to this position, I know what it's like to have to rely on public assistance, and I know the embarrassment of that. I know what it's like to live so frugally that you have to tell your children no on things that other children get, and then your children don't grow up with as rounded childhood as you wish they would have had. I know what it's like to struggle to provide for your family day in and day out. Fortunately, I had the support of a union. I had the tool of collective bargaining, and over the years, I was able to fight for a higher wage for my coworkers and myself and get to a point where we didn't have to survive, but we could actually get ahead, and where eventually I could buy a house and even contribute to my children's college education. But so many workers do not have the vehicle I had. And ironically and unfortunately, even my sisters and my brothers in my union are not all making the wages that they deserve, but are making low wages. About half the workers SEIU 503 represents make wages that do not give them the security to adequately provide for their households with a path to get ahead. And we are also here supporting a minimum wage increase to stand up for all workers. Therefore, we adamantly support raising the minimum wage, and the 15 Now campaign is essential to lifting up workers from the bottom, giving them the dignity and respect for the work they do, and also creating a robust economy that works for all. No worker living in Oregon and their families should live in poverty and without hope of escaping it. That makes this not only an economic and sociological issue, but a moral imperative as well. And that is why our union is joined in partnership on this issue with faith, labor, and community allies, as well as a majority of Oregonians to support a minimum wage increase. Without dispute, workers who make substandard wages, about 400,000 workers or 25% of our workforce in Oregon, can't adequately care for themselves or their families. Corporations paying these low wages, many out of state, are left off the hook for providing for their workers despite huge profits they reap on the back of these workers. Many of their employees are forced to rely on public assistance to survive, like I did, putting an incredible strain on taxpayers and public budgets. A full-time minimum wage worker falls below the federal poverty level for a family of three, making $19,240 a year. Research done by the Economic Policy Institute shows nationally 88% of low-wage workers are over 20 years old, over 35% are at least 40, 56% are women, and 28% have children. Nearly a half million 4- and 2-year college graduates, many with suffocating student loan debt, have settled for low-wage jobs because there are no higher-paying jobs for them. The collateral damage of low wages is hundreds of thousands of low-wage workers who can't participate as consumers in their own economy, thereby bogging down the potential growth of local and state economies. Workers toiling at multiple jobs, sometimes both parents, simply so families can survive. And I'm going to tell a short story about parents with two children. Both parents worked two jobs each. They took mass transit to their jobs, jobs of 8 hours each. And you can imagine what little time they had to spend with their children and how worn out and fatigued they were from those jobs. But that was a necessity in just getting by. So parents who have minimal time with their children, often leaving children on their own, increasing domestic stress and trauma. Unhealthy communities underfunded on vital services when low-wage workers draw from the revenue stream via public assistance instead of paying taxes. But the indirect benefits of increasing wages are community businesses that thrive because workers have more spending power, healthier families when parents make enough so they can spend more time with their children in schooling, more involvement in community affairs and activities when workers are freed from overwhelming work schedules of long hours and multiple jobs. All wages rise, everyone shares more and more fully in the wealth generated by national, state, and local economies, which are nurtured with more consumers and in turn create more jobs in an upward spiral of progress, not a plummet to the bottom. You will hear a lot from opposition over the coming day or days, but much of the claims are not true. For instance, in Seattle, the claim from opposition that numerous restaurants had closed due to higher wages was recently debunked in several news articles. They had, in fact, closed due to natural causes, so many restaurants succumbed to. Nationally, about 50,000 restaurants close each year. We've also heard the fear-mongering of the $8 to $10 burger if the wages of fast food workers are raised. In Denmark, McDonald's workers make twice as much as in the United States, have paid sick leave, and a burger costs 35 cents more than it does here. With overwhelming support coming from faith, labor, and community groups, as well as broad support from Oregonians, we will continue to work towards a higher wage until we are successful. Fellow Oregonians can't continue to go to work every day and have their families be living in poverty. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. Colleagues, questions of anyone on this panel? Okay, I want to thank you all for coming up here. And
thank you, Chair Dembrone, committee.
Thank you. All right, our next panel is Jan Meekums, Betsy Earls, and Eric Kurtz. Please come up.
It's quiet.
Hi, Jan.
Hi. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for National Federation of Independent Business, NFIB. We have about 7,000 privately owned businesses that are a member of our Oregon Association. We also have about 350,000 members nationwide. NFIB has been advocating on behalf of small businesses since 1943, and we have one of the largest small business research foundations in the country, with the exception of the Small Business Administration. So we've been following small business for decades. This is a very important issue to Oregon. It has an impact on families. It has an impact on our economy. Our viewpoint and our research and our experience has given us a little different viewpoint than what you've been hearing. NFIB has done a state-specific research on minimum wage since 2012 through 2014. Illinois research raising minimum wage from $9.25 to $10.65 indicated that there would be approximately a 45,000 job loss. Massachusetts in July 2013 raising their minimum wage to $11 an hour would give about a 62,000 job loss. New Jersey raising their minimum wage to $8.25, a 31,000 job loss. California to $9.25, a 68,000 job loss. New York in 2012 raising it to $8.50, a 22,000 job loss. And this is supported by the Congressional Budget Office in 2014. Their research resulted in if there was a $10.10 minimum wage nationally, that there would be approximately estimated a 500,000 job loss. And our individual state research supports that. I have some, and you can, OLIS, I provided on OLIS a link to all of those studies, and including the Congressional Budget Office study. There's another issue regarding job loss, and there's an article from March of 2014, The Shift from Low-Wage Worker to Robot Worker, that talks about how computerization will take over jobs when they get to the point that minimum wage is beyond the capacity to sustain the business. We had a person at the Oregon Business Plan who has a seafood processing company, and he said if the minimum wage goes to $15 an hour, what takes him 45 employees to accomplish, he can automate and accomplish with 3 employees. We believe that minimum wage predominantly is younger workers, part-time workers, those entering the workforce. This is a small business issue for the reasons that big corporations do not have to absorb the cost of minimum wage increases because most minimum wage jobs are offered by small businesses. Small businesses are the least able to absorb such a dramatic increase in their labor costs. The small business sector has historically created 2/3 of net new private jobs in the U.S. economy, but it has been slower to recover from the Great Recession in recent years because of a series of policies that increase the burden on small businesses, such as higher taxes, increases to health care costs, more costly regulations, and now the minimum wage increase proposal. The minimum wage directly affects small businesses because a large amount of their earnings go directly to pay for operating expenses, such as equipment, supplies, lease or mortgage, credit lines, inventory, and, of course, employee wage and benefits. Several of our members will be testifying today. They've already provided written testimony that's on OLIS saying the exact impact that this wage proposal would have on them. The typical response that we've gotten is that they will have to cut employees. Particularly, it is the part-time employee and the low-wage employee that will be impacted the most. They will have to cut benefits, raise prices, and in some cases, we have a 62-year-old company that is saying it could be the proverbial straw, and they may have to close their doors, and their employees would lose their jobs. And that's basically all I want to say today. The rest of it is in my testimony. There's documented substantial research to support our position. And with that, I thank you again for your time today, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you very much, Jan. Betsy, you want to go next?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, appearing before you to discuss the minimum wage bills before the legislature today. I think that most of what I wanted to say has actually been covered by Ms. Meekums, but I would like to talk with you a little bit about the impact of an increased minimum wage on manufacturers, because that's a sector of the economy that doesn't often get discussed when it comes to minimum wage increases. As you all know, Oregon's economy is heavily supported by manufacturing, particularly in high tech, but those manufacturers face very serious competition from their overseas counterparts, both inside and outside their companies. One of our manufacturing members mentioned to me last week that some of the stiffest competition that they face is from their parent company's other plants around the globe. That plant in Oregon competes with those other plants for orders around the globe, in particular with the plants in Asia. And the parent company is concerned about the Oregon plant's competitiveness in view of the fact that the Asia plant has payroll costs that are a third less than Oregon's. If the Oregon plant becomes even less competitive, the owners will simply move those jobs to other parts of the world. There are two things that I really wanted to make sure that you knew or understood about minimum wage workers in manufacturing. One is that they're typically entry-level workers, and their pay increases with experience. As they move up, others move in to take their place as entry-level workers. The other is that they're frequently provided with benefit packages that significantly increase their overall compensation. So the fact that they're entry-level employees whose wages will increase with experience is important because it means that a mandated minimum wage increase is going to cause wage compression within that company, where an employee who's worked for several years at their job going from minimum wage up to $15, $16 an hour is not going to be terribly happy to see new employees starting out at those same rates. And that's a cost that's pretty hard to quantify in terms of actual dollars in a company, but it will be a difficult issue to manage. The fact that entry-level employees have a substantial benefit package in many manufacturing firms means that to stay competitive, a manufacturer will have to shift their labor costs by decreasing benefits. The tax implications for employees in this scenario really are not great because wages, as you know, are taxed income, whereas benefits like 401k matches or health insurance coverage are not. So instead of simply mandating that employers increase the minimum wage and pay more, I would encourage you this session to really look for and support policies that strengthen the economy and put workers in a better position to earn higher wages based on their improved education and skills. You know, just to one of the comments that an earlier testimony made about what happens if service employees move up in the economy and quit making minimum wage, who will be the next serviced employees. I think that's a really important point because I think a lot of the business community sees minimum wage jobs as entry-level positions and areas where you can begin to gain experience before you move on up the ladder in the economy and other people will take your place. What we would hope is that there is enough support for those employees and the companies that employ them, that they can train the employees sufficiently to increase their skills and economic productivity to do that. And I passed out the job killer list. I think you've all seen that before.
It looks like our committee agenda.
Isn't it great? I know it. I gave it to you again just because there's a more in-depth piece that we did on minimum wage increases attached to the back of it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Dumbro, committee members, my name is Eric Fruits. I'm a Portland area economist. I have a
PhD in economics. I've also written articles in peer-reviewed journals, some of the top journals. I've also had stuff that's been published in The Economist and The Wall Street Journal. I also did some research, which I just distributed to you, for the Oregon Neighborhood Stores Association, and so I'm going to talk about the minimum wage today. There's an old expression that goes, no good deed goes unpunished. And the minimum wage legislation that we're considering here, it is a good deed, but it also puts out a lot of punishment, and it punishes those that were trying to help. Let's take a look at some of the most vulnerable in our labor force, and those are the young. If we look at young people, we see that not only do we have huge unemployment, in other words, they're looking for jobs and they can't get them. We also have declining labor force participation. Now, we've seen this in the U.S., but Oregon is worse. Our unemployment rate among our youth is about 5 percentage points higher. Our labor force participation rate among our youth is lower. In other words, we have more people who are looking for work that can't find it, and they've given up looking, and they become members of the Xbox Army, surfing their couches during the summer, just waiting for July 1 when recreational marijuana will turn unemployment into fun employment. It's not just young people we're talking about, though. We're also talking about disabled people. We're talking about people who are maybe just trying to start to get their lives back on track, people who need to get into a new job and build their skills back up. And it's not just me saying this. If we look at economic evidence, for example, we could take a look at the Congressional Budget Office, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room have relied on Congressional Budget Office work before. It's good work, and it's a comprehensive review of the literature that's out there already. And what we found is that minimum wage increases have big impacts in the economy on employment and on wage and salary income. And that was just looking at a federal minimum wage increase. State-level impacts are always bigger because, as we've heard before, businesses can pick up and move across state lines. If we take a look at some of the exhibits I've distributed that I put on OLIS, you'll see that wage and salary income in Oregon has actually not kept pace with the rest of the United States. And this is even though we have had steadily increasing minimum wages since, certainly since 2004 when we began indexing the minimum wage. Even though we have annual increases in the minimum wage, we have still seen over time our average wage and salary income has declined. So when we take a look at these minimum wage bills under consideration, we also need to take a look at what is the net impact. Sure, some people are going to see a bigger impact. They're going to see a boost in their salaries. But offsetting that are going to be the people who lose their jobs. They may not lose their jobs. They may be trying to find a job that they can't get. My estimate of a $12 minimum wage would have about 50,000 fewer people working. That's not too far at odds with what the Legislative Revenue Office estimated the impact would be back in July for a slightly smaller increase in the minimum wage. We both found that there would be long-run negative impacts both on employment and incomes. And again, that's not just us saying that. That's a whole body of research, and not just research from think tanks. I'm talking about published research in academic journals. As a matter of fact, my study, the work I did was mostly in January, and it was before these measures came out. But just a couple weeks ago, there's an article that came out in probably one of the top journals in economics, so top that if I had it published there, I would probably be having tenure instead of sitting here today. The title of the article is How Effective is the Minimum Wage at Supporting the Poor? And I think it's a really important article, and it's worth reading, although it's a little wonky. But the author's conclusions are stunning. He finds, and this is pretty stunning, the costs imposed by the minimum wage are paid in a way that is more regressive than a sales tax. That's more regressive than a sales tax. As much as we hate sales taxes here in Oregon because they're so regressive, a minimum wage increase is worse. Now, why is that? Well, if you look at what happens with a minimum wage, about 20 to 25% of it off the top goes away in taxes, payroll taxes, income taxes. That's money that the employee never gets to see. Another chunk goes into spending. We've talked about this kind of trickle-down economics where people might spend more money. They spend more money, but they may not buy more stuff because those additional costs are going to get passed through the economy. They're going to pay more for milk and for meals and for other things. And so they may be spending more, but they're not getting more. And so on net, what this research has found is that the impact is actually regressive and actually hurts the people that we're trying to help. And that leads us back to the idea that raising the minimum wage, it is a good idea. It's in the sense that it's a good deed, but it's a good deed that punishes those that it's meant to help.
Thank you, Dr. Fritz. Vice Chair Thatcher.
Dr.
Fruits.
Fruits, thank
yes.
you. Hey, previous testimony said that hamburger and where they raised the minimum wage way up, I don't remember what the number was, but was only 35 cents more than it is here. And I think it was at McDonald's. How would you account for that? Is it because that's a larger company and therefore they can absorb that cost more than, say, a smaller business?
Well, every company is different, and you may hear testimony today from some small businesses who say, you know, raise the minimum wage. It's going to be great. It's going to be great for me, and it may be great for that business, but it may not be great for other businesses. You might have a larger fast food chain that could absorb those costs. They could do it through automation. But if you're someone who is, say, you know, making your hamburgers by hand and hand grinding the meat, you may see a much steeper rise in the price of your burgers. So we can't just say, oh, well, the price of a burger is going to go up by 35 cents. I remember there was a story a couple months ago, where President Obama got a sandwich at a place that paid $15 an hour. Well, what wasn't really covered in that story was it's about a $15 sandwich. And that's not something that we tend to go out and have very often.
Senator Rosemary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meekums, I was curious about your testimony about it being primarily younger workers who are working at the minimum wage, because I'm looking at material that we were provided perhaps by staff that comes from the Employment Department, and their statistics are showing, I think, approximately 49.6% of minimum wage workers are 25 years or older, which then certainly by anybody's calculation, unless you're talking about that age group,
yeah,
that's almost half of people.
Actually, I've looked at that information, and that's about right. If you look at the average worker, they tend to be a little bit older, but there's also a high proportion that are younger. Also, it's important to remember that if you look at a household that has a minimum wage earner in Oregon, the average household with a minimum wage earner makes about $42,000 a year. That's about twice the federal poverty rate for a family of three or four. That's because the minimum wage earner typically is not the only wage earner in the house. And so when you have that additional wage in there, you actually see much higher incomes. For example, if my son got a minimum wage job, we would be considered a minimum wage household.
May I add to that, Chair?
Please, please do.
And members of the committee and Senator Rosenbaum. There, I am quoting from the U.S. Department of Bureau of Labor Statistics on the first page of my testimony, where it says a minimum wage worker tends to be young, although workers under age 25 represented only about one-fifth of hourly paid workers, they made up about half of those paid the federal minimum wage. And there is this, I think there's a link to that study as well. So that's where
and if,
that quote came
just
from.
A comment, Mr. Chair, but that would mean that half were over 25, right?
Yeah.
And that's not what you meant by younger people then.
Well, I consider 25
is kind of young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've actually been wrestling with this notion of what a young worker is all session. Our very first hearing, we had Graham Slater from the Employment Division come and talk to us about that. And I think, you know, when most of us think of younger workers, you know, we're thinking of those teenagers, you know, who are working while they're in high school or immediately after, and then, you know, who move on up. But you know, even with what's being considered here, the younger worker, age 24 and younger, I mean, by then, a lot of people are already, you know, very much supporting their families, right? They may have a couple of kids. I had at least one when I was that age. And, you know, they're not exactly what we think of as somebody earning a training wage, you know, as it were, who's going to do it for a few months or a year, and then we'll move up the wage scale. I think one of the challenges that we're finding is that people are getting stuck down at that lower level. And, you know, that's why I think this call for, okay, let's have an adjustment upwards.
Well, and that's an important point too, Chairman Dumbro, because there was another study that came out a few months ago that actually found that when you increase the minimum wage, it becomes harder for people to move up that ladder because they find themselves stuck at that lower level for longer. That's tougher to get promoted and work your way up that ladder, and that actually compresses and keeps you down from moving, that when you have a lower minimum wage, that people do tend to move up the ladder faster. And so I could send you that research. I think it's a fairly compelling argument that shows that you know, maybe that's not the case.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Gelser, then Senator Smith.
Thank you. On the question of young workers, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. Has anyone broken it down to define young worker as under the age of 18? So what portion of those are under the age of 18 and what portion are age 18 to 24 that are self-supporting adults that may be supporting families as well, not kind of the teenagers at the summer jobs?
Well, Bureau of Labor Statistics breaks out the age groups into 16, 19, 19, and 24. They tend to group the 16 to 24 together and report that. That data seems to be a bit richer. So if you want to continue on this research, you could break it down to 16 to 19. Then you have to marry that information with what's known as the current population survey that's done separately. And that's where you get the information on how many of those people in each of those age groups would have children, were married, work full-time and part-time. One of the challenges you have with getting that data down that narrowly is that, especially on the state level, is that your data set's pretty thin, and so the numbers are a little less reliable. But it can be done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep. I think one of the reasons I'm interested in that, I know I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people last year on their doorsteps, and the number of people that talked about really struggling to make ends meet while working minimum wage weren't teenagers. They were a lot of single moms that had a couple kids at home that were working more than one job, and this was a primary issue that they raised time and again without prompting or being asked.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosenbaum brought up, I think, a good point about minimum wage workers kind of average age and about half below, half above. But if you look at the profile that was sent to us by Graham Slater, it's really interesting because 46% of people who are making minimum wage are working in food prep and service related. 64% of those making the minimum wage are part-time. 66%, almost 69%, have never been married. About 58% have a high school diploma or less, about half and half in that group. 77% are white, 62%, so heavily female, 62% women making the minimum wage. And then the average age, half 16 to 24, half 25 years or older. And I think that's just very instructive. The other thing that I thought was instructive, two things. One, I heard 10% of the workforce was minimum wage, where Graham Slater indicates that that's 6% of the workforce in Oregon, which is 103,000 people. And of those 103,000, the highest counties for having minimum wage workers are Malheur, Harney, and Wheeler. On the low end at 4% is Multnomah, 4.5% Gilliam, Washington County 4.6, and Morrow at 4.7, and then Clackamas at 5.8, and then my county 5.9% of the workforce. And so I think those just are very interesting statistics that I think it would be great for us to keep in mind as we look at the issue.
Thank you. Yes, Senator.
Just one more data question. On the part-time workers, is there any way to break out how many of those that are holding part-time jobs, those are second or third jobs that individuals are holding in addition to their full-time part-time job in order to make ends meet, as opposed to I just have a part-time job, I have a full-time job and two part-time jobs?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I don't know offhand how that data is structured. I know that in the current population statistic survey data, they actually break it out by number of hours that are worked per week, but I don't know if they break out those hours by different jobs. I seem to recall seeing some data where they have, you could identify different jobs, but I'm not quite sure on that. I know that you could definitely break out the hours worked. So I can tell you how many people work 10 or fewer hours a week, how many work 30 or fewer hours a week, and so forth.
And that follow-up? And that's broken out by the person, not by job. So if that person had four different employers, you could get the total number of hours worked by that individual across multiple employers?
Right, roughly speaking, yes. And like you said, that data is at the micro level. It's on the individual level. You can get, there's a separate line for each person.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question for you, Betsy, but before that, I do want to say that although two-thirds of the worker, minimum wage workers, have never been married, that doesn't mean that they don't have dependents. You know, I think we have heard a lot of single parents are in this situation. With the manufacturing, so how many minimum wage manufacturing workers are there? I don't think of them at that as being a place where you find, you know, a lot of minimum wage workers who also, you know, get the kind of benefits you mentioned. Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chair, the sense that I have is that it's a pretty low percentage. It's fewer than 10%, between 10 and 15% of our manufacturing workforce. And it is primarily entry-level jobs for people that will move up, presumably, to, you know, quite well-paying wages, you know, over a couple of years. I can get an exact, but.
Great. Thank you.
A lot.
Okay, thank you, all three of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Providing us with a lot of information. Okay, next we have Stephen Michael, Chuck Cheketov, Justin Norton Kurtzen, and Daniel Morris. Okay, and again, you have about 15, maybe 20 minutes among the four of you.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Stephen Michael. I'm the State Director of the Main Street Alliance of Oregon, Chair Dembro Committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I submitted my testimony in writing, so I won't go through in the interest of time as well, to just kind of reading through everything. But I will say that as an organization, the Main Street Alliance of Oregon works with over 2,500 small business owners across the state. And we support raising the minimum wage to $15 by 2018. I think it's really important to note, and from talking with a lot of our members about this issue as well, we're not talking about going from 9:25 to 15 tomorrow. It's really important to think through the kind of transition implications for small businesses to make sure that they have enough time to work it into their budgets as well. But I will say that small business owners know that an investment in their employees is the smartest investment they can make in their business. Small business owners, we work with 95% of those are 25 and fewer employees. These are mom and pop shops. We meet them by literally walking across, like walking Main Street districts all across the state, going in and asking if the business owner is there. So the business owners are working families too. They're there in their shops day in and day out, and they're doing everything from HR to running the shop to ordering to everything in between, cleaning bathrooms. Without their employees, they would have to also be doing all of the other work that their employees are doing. And so if they don't have happy employees, healthy employees that are feeling respected and want to come to work, they're going to drive away customers. Competition is fierce. Small businesses are tough. Running a small business is a challenging thing to do. And so finding ways to make sure that your team, that your employees, that your staff are feeling respected, are feeling like they're being treated well, and valued as individuals, is something that's very important, not only to our members, but also to the workforce. Additionally, I'd say that the biggest thing that we hear from folks when we're out talking to people, we ask a question, as a small business owner, what do you need most to get the economy back on track and create more jobs? Is it lower taxes, fewer regulations, more customers, or something else? 68% of the people that we've talked to said more customers. More customers, thinking about it, it seems like obviously you'd want more customers. But it's important in this conversation because what makes a customer is somebody that's got money in their pockets. And if we, you'll hear about the data from Mr. Cheketov, but an increase to $15 by 2018 will add $3.2 billion to our economy in Oregon. And we know that the folks that are earning the least in our communities spend the highest percentage of their paychecks in their local communities. And so when people at the bottom tier of wage earners are seeing an increase, they're spending that money, and they're spending it locally. And so that's money that's being circulated through small businesses that we work with, Main Streets, helping to keep those Main Streets thriving. So not only did business owners
overwhelmingly say that they need more customers. We've been asking about minimum wage increase, knowing that this was going to be a topic that was going to come up. And 90% of the business owners we talked to agreed that an Oregonian working full time should not be living in poverty. And yet there are thousands of full-time working Oregonians who are earning a minimum wage and are making just over $19,000 a year on that minimum wage. And that's not enough to be able to get by, to be able to support your family and be able to make sure that that you're not living less than paycheck to paycheck. And 67% of the folks that we talked to would support an increase in the minimum wage. What that number means or what that number lands on, we've been anecdotally hearing, different people saying different things all across the board. And you'll hear from a number of our members later tonight in the public hearing from small business owners themselves who have varying views on what that number needs to be. But we know that with over 2/3 of small business owners saying this is something that needs to happen, we think this is something that should happen. And it's really simple because when there's an influx of money into the pockets of our customers, they're the ones that are able to continue to support small businesses in our communities. So I'll say that not only is raising the minimum wage good for workers, good for working families, good for Oregonians, and really good for business. It's also great for our state budget because we know that when people are able to be more self-sufficient, that's less strain on our tax dollar, that's less strain on the social services, which means that the people that really need to depend on those social services to get by, to help get back on their feet, can, and those resources will be there for them. When you're considering this conversation, this topic, be sure to remember from small businesses. We can say that, and I'm sure you'll hear from other small business owners who are not supportive of this, but we've seen the data, we've seen the research, we know what's happening in other places across the country and across the world, that when you increase the minimum wage, it helps small business. So if you want to help small businesses in Oregon, raise the wage.
Thank you, Sigma.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chuck Schechtbaugh, the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I've submitted printed testimony for the record and a number of reports, which I'm sure will appear in OLIS in the not-too-distant future. So I'm going to talk about the impacts on the economy and businesses. I first want to point out that we have a paper, one of the ones that we've submitted, looking at the poor families in Oregon, families with children who are poor, at least in over half of them, 51%, at least one parent worked less than full time in the past year. And another 21% of them, at least one parent worked full time. So what does that mean? 72% of poor families with children have a parent in the household who worked in the past year. That's why raising the minimum wage is key to reducing poverty in this state. They wouldn't be poor if they were being paid more. I want to start by saying there's precedent for this increase. In 1950, the Congress raised the minimum wage 88% just overnight, essentially, and the world went on. But the Oregon legislature, has been referred to earlier by Senator Rosenbaum, in 1989 raised the minimum wage, which then stood at $3.35, to $4.75. They did it in three steps. That fall of 1989, it went up a little bit to $3.85, then in January 1 of 90 to $4.25, and then $4.75. That's a 42% increase. And so there's precedent for this because our proposal that we've sort of been looking at are the two companion bills, Senate Bill 610 and House Bill 2009, that raised the 15 over 3 years. And the first 2 years of those bills would go up 43%, essentially the same. The question that I would ask the NFIB and the Restaurant Association is, teach us, how did you survive those increases back from 1989 forward? Look at they've had big increases in the number of people working in restaurants since then, and they did survive it. And so we should learn from them how they did it. And those would be the questions. I think some of their claims about changes in the minimum wage in other states, they confuse correlation as if there is correlation with causation, and they're not the same thing. Minimum wage would boost the economic security of all those poor families who are now working and others. We've worked with the Economic Policy Institute to come up with a preliminary estimate. I want to be clear that that's what it is, that would show that about 589,000 workers would benefit directly over the three-year period from going up to $15. Another about 114,000, again a preliminary estimate, would also see their wages go up because they'd be indirectly affected. They're slightly above the minimum when the wage goes up, and so their wages will go up as well. It would affect an estimated 350,000 children would have at least one parent who would see increased income directly or indirectly if we raised it to $15 over that three-year period. And it's important to note that a higher minimum wage for parents means a lifetime of economic benefits for children and for the state. For low-income children, increases in income tend to lead to higher academic achievement and increased earnings when those children become adults. Raising the minimum wage would help with that. What would happen to jobs in the state? The impact of minimum wage increases has been studied sort of almost ad nausea. It's one of the most studied areas of economics. And the bottom line conclusion is any job loss would be minimal. That it just doesn't have that. Even the CBO study shows that there's 49 people who get benefits from the minimum wage increase for everyone who might lose a job. And that study has been criticized by the President's Council of Economic Advisors and others for the range that CBO shows on that, focusing on teens. Oregon's small businesses, we released a paper earlier last week about how Oregon's small businesses have done fine with the minimum wage. We're not saying the minimum wage increase caused them to do better. It's just that we looked at the number of establishments and the number of employees over time, and there's a graph in the testimony and in the report showing that they've been on a steady increase in Oregon. Their downturns are when you have the recession. That's important. Again, I would ask the restaurateurs, what did you do? And I'd ask small business folks, no, forget the economic studies by academics, because that's just using models and la-la land sort of stuff. Ask the businesses who were here in 1989 or are still here today or were there in 1989 and lasted until the late 90s or early 2000s. They will show you that... they can continue. You know, the minimum wage, why does it not, it defies sort of the textbook economics is you raise the wage, prices will go up and people will lose jobs. But that's not how the world works. It's sort of a nice theory to teach people the basics. That's not how the world works. One of the ways it works, as was alluded to earlier, is that you get better employees. In fact, I was out in Pendleton a couple months ago, and I was talking to a restaurant owner, and he said, I always pay higher than minimum wage because I need my employees to be able to do lots of different things here. They have to know a lot of the jobs here, not just one job. And it takes so much time to train someone, I need low turnover. Turnover is incredibly expensive. And so that's why he pays more, so that he has low turnover. And I think smart business people know that, and that's why the minimum wage is good for business and good for Oregon. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, my name is Justin Norton Kurtzen. I'm a representative of 15 Now Oregon. Oregon's economy has been growing at 3 times the national rate, but the recovery has hardly been felt by working people because wages have been stagnant for decades and have not kept pace with the cost of living. You have an opportunity to help change this by taking a strong stand for Oregon's working families and passing a $15 minimum wage. Studies from the University of Washington, Alliance for a Just Society, and the National Low Income Housing Coalition all place a living wage for the state of Oregon at above $15 per hour. So it's not just that 15 is a nationwide movement that has inspired workers across the country. Rather, it's that 15 is actually the right number for Oregon. Right now, some 600,000 working Oregonians earn less than $15 per hour, almost a third of the working people in our state. Some 200,000 of them make so little that they're still eligible for public benefits. And Oregon taxpayers pay over $1.7 billion per year to subsidize the low wages of massively wealthy corporations that pay little to no taxes here in Oregon. Frankly, I'm a little bit appalled by this line of argument that I'm hearing, that somehow, some way, more money in the pockets of low-wage workers is going to be bad for them. And I wonder if business leaders would come and testify to the idea that more money in the pockets of business owners and CEOs and shareholders is going to be somehow bad for them and their businesses. I highly doubt it. Anything less than 15 in Oregon is not enough. It isn't enough for Ian, a college graduate living in Eugene and working at a call center for poverty wages. It isn't enough for Janice, who drives a school bus in Portland and struggles to feed her family. It's time for working people in Oregon to get the fair share of the wealth and the strong economy that they have helped create. We can ensure that no one in our state who works lives in poverty, or we can keep wasting tax dollars to subsidize the poverty wages of big business. Now think about it. No one who works should live in poverty. This is a basic moral value, and this basic moral value is the reason why over 100 labor unions, faith organizations, and community organizations have joined the fight for 15 in Oregon. It's why we've engaged with hundreds of volunteers all over the state, and it's why thousands of Oregonians have signed petitions in support of a $15 minimum wage. It's why these people are ready to act. It's why this Wednesday, rallies, marches, and worksite actions for a $15 minimum wage will take place all over the state of Oregon as part of a National Day of Action for 15. The working people of Oregon have been activated, and they're demanding 15 now. No one who works should live in poverty, and you have an opportunity to help make this basic moral value a reality in Oregon. 15 is the right number, and 15 now Oregon won't compromise on this number because anything less is not enough. Because this is about what's right for working people, not about what deal we can strike with big business. We call on this committee and the state legislature, and we demand that Oregon's minimum wage be raised to $15 per hour. If you fail to act, this movement will still win.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Justin. Mr. Morris.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. I'm happy to be here today testifying in support of raising Oregon's minimum wage. A significant increase in the minimum wage would improve the lots of hundreds of thousands of Oregonians and actually provide a significant boost to our economy at a time when we really need it for many families. Just in the interest of time, I'll be brief. I just wanted to just speak kind of directly about a couple of the claims this committee heard earlier that I thought were maybe misleading or just untrue. First off, I just want to say that I think that the focus on the data on just people who are currently earning the minimum wage doesn't tell the whole story because there are, as we know, many thousands of people who are earning more than the minimum wage but still earning low wages. So over a quarter of our workforce earns less than $12 an hour. Those are low wages. As Chuck mentioned, almost 600,000 people earn less than $15 an hour. When I looked at data on about 197,000 working adults in Oregon who had been working but are still were receiving food stamps in January of 2014, their average wage was around $12.36 an hour for that group. So so even though many I'm sure were actually earning minimum wages, but just because someone's earning a little more, even a few dollars more, that doesn't mean that's a high wage job or a job that is providing a kind of a family income. And then the other thing that I've kept hearing, and I have to be honest, I cringe a little every time I hear it, is these really bold claims about job losses, and I can say that I think that these claims are really wholly unfounded, and I want to kind of say this for I guess for a couple of reasons. So first, there have been hundreds of studies published on the effects of minimum wage increases in different states or countries, and it's sort of easy to go cherry pick a study here and there that says what you want to have said. But to truly evaluate this body of scientific evidence, it's really necessary to do a systematic review of all the studies and to weight them based on the quality of the methods and the factors they considered and so forth. And when those studies are done, they find essentially that sort of across the board, the kind of the average overall effect of a minimum wage increase is negligible to zero, basically. So there's really not strong evidence that a minimum wage increase has any impact on jobs, in sort of either the short term or the long term. And I think any sort of claims that are made based on kind of counter to that are really not supported by the kind of the weight of the scientific evidence. And we heard specifically about a report put out by the Congressional Budget Office. And, you know, what you, I guess, didn't hear about that report is that they said, this was a few years ago, but they estimated that, you know, raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour would directly raise wages for over 16.5 million people, indirectly raise wages for another 8 million. It would actually add $19 billion of new wage income into the economy and lift nearly a million people out of poverty. So those are actually really promising numbers, and I think really encouraging evidence that a higher minimum wage actually achieves some really significant positive effects. The piece, of course, that opponents of the minimum wage focus on is a part of the CBO analysis, again relating to job losses. And I think that particular part of their analysis has actually been subject to a lot of criticisms. That the studies that they were based on have some serious methodological flaws. Authors who worked on these bigger systematic reviews of the studies of minimum wage impacts have really drawn that analysis into question, and really I think have written and spoken pretty strongly that those job loss estimates really shouldn't be believed. And I'd be happy to supply some of those critiques to the committee for your consideration. So again, just in the interest of time, I really thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to talk, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. And that would be great if we could get some of the meta-analyses that are done.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a book by Dale Bellman and Paul Wolfson that came out subsequent to the CBO report called The New Minimum Wage Research, which for some might be good for cures for insomnia, but they did that meta-analysis is what the book does. And at one point it says, bearing in mind that the estimates for the United States reflect a historic experience of moderate increases in the minimum wage, it appears that if negative effects on employment are present, they are too small to be statistically detectable. Such effects would be too modest to have meaningful consequences in the dynamically changing labor markets of the United States. I also meant to mention, I made a note while the last panel was up, my staff looked up employment and manufacturing in the minimum wage. So the data is from the first two quarters of 2014, and it breaks it down by different dollar amounts on our wage level, but 5% of people working in manufacturing earn less than $10, the minimum wage, and 26% earn less than $15.
Thank you. Colleagues, do you have any questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thanks. I'm hearing that it helps small business, it boosts the economy, and the weight of scientific evidence indicates there's no impact on a loss of jobs. Why do you stop at 15? Why don't you go to 50 or 100 or so? Seems like you're aiming low. I'm just wondering.
I mean, is that a serious question?
I am. Where do you come up with 15?
Well, I mean, for one, as I stated, there have been a number of studies that point to 15 as the number for Oregon that is a living wage, which is defined as enough to be able to provide adequate housing and food and childcare and healthcare and transportation for a family. And has been pointed out, I think, that a lot of these workers are single mothers and people with families. And so I think that there's a really strong basis for 15 being the right number here in Oregon. In terms of why not higher, I think there are definitely places in Oregon where it probably should be higher. I know the University of Washington study on the self-sufficiency standard places a living wage, a self-sufficiency standard for the Tri-County Portland area, Washington County, Clackamas, and Multnomah, at over $21 an hour.
So maybe we should be shooting higher, but 15 is what is viable at this point. And I mean, would you vote for a $20 an hour minimum wage?
I don't believe what you're saying, but
right. Well, so we're
I'm just wondering why the 15, where it came from. So
is viable given the current political climate,
and okay,
it's the
so
number
viable.
That has also been shown to be the right number for Oregon's wage.
Okay. Well, I just wonder because it sounds like it's a sort of a national movement for the 15. I hear it all over.
Sure.
That's a number that's going everywhere. That it's good everywhere, and so I'm just wondering why it's good for Oregon, mm-hmm. also. Because I know that we have a lower cost of living here versus, say, other places, New York or New Jersey or back east.
Sure.
Yeah. Or even Washington.
Well, you can look at national averages. You could look at state averages. Obviously, it's going to differ city by city or region by region as well.
Certainly.
Okay, thank you very much, panel. Okay, we'll move now to our last panel, and that is Bill Puri and John Zielinski, please. And while they're coming up, I wanted to let everyone know that we have already received a lot of written testimony that is posted on OLIS, and we are welcoming more. So. Any of you here in the audience, remember today's panels are all invited testimony. Tonight will be public testimony, but I know many people won't be able to testify orally. But we'll be taking written testimony, I think till we'll do the same thing as last time, through Friday.
At 5 p.m.
Friday at 5 p.m. is your last chance. So please, you know, we are hoping to have votes on these bills a week from today. So if you could get them in by Friday, that'll give us a chance to review all the written testimony before the votes. So, Bill, welcome.
Hey, welcome. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. First, I just kind of wanted to start out. I'm going to have kind of an industry-specific main thrust to my testimony, but I just want to give a few kind of brief comments. And first of all, you know, you hear all these people talking about, you know, impacts of business that are coming from, I would say, the proponents of the measure. But at the same token, you know, we've had a higher than average minimum wage in Oregon, and we tend to lead the country in unemployment and poverty. So I would just say that this has not been a solution if you just look at Oregon-specific as we've dealt with in the past. And so I do think there are certain things that address when you're talking about single parents trying to live at these wages that you could do that almost everybody would agree on, because I think that's a goal we all need to be looking at. It just seems like this tends to be more of a political topic that we deal with every time, and it connects it to this issue. But I think that poverty is a bigger issue, and since we've had a higher than average minimum wage, it's not been a solution to that in Oregon, if we're just looking at Oregon. And when this kind of came up last October, November, I went into my daycare and asked them, you know, what's going to happen if minimum wage goes to $12 an hour? The next day when I picked up my son, he came in and he told me that there were two kids he hired after high school. He'd probably eliminate those positions, and he'd probably raise the rates at about 18%, which, you know, you get back kind of the core of what we're talking about here. If you're just the average Joe that's, say, a 20-year-old, that might be money in the pocket if you don't lose any hours. If you've got a single child and you look at food costs and daycare costs going up, you're probably a push whether or not you are better off. If you've got two kids in daycare, you've lost at that point in time. And so when you do a cross-the-board increase in minimum wage, remember, minimum wage workers tend to use minimum wage services. They shop at quick service, they go to daycare, they do all these different things. So if you just look at that general population, multiple kids on a minimum wage, and you raise the minimum wage in those services, they're probably not going to benefit from it. And so if you want to have a conversation about minimum wage, obviously there are some very specific things in our industry that some of you that have been around for a while have heard about it, but I have to bring it up. Tip credit. It's the big issue. Okay, over half the people in our industry that are minimum wage get tips. Okay, in here, there's studies, there's everything else, that basically you cannot have a tip server on the floor that doesn't make double the minimum wage. It's just not economically feasible. We can get into that deeper if you would like to, if you have questions. But, and that's not talking about the restaurant that's got a tip jar up front. That's a server. And so in those same situations currently, everybody that's in the back of the house is making between $12 and $15 an hour. Now, if you raise the wages for the people in the back of the house, food costs are going to go up, okay, which means the tips go up. That's how the system is supposed to work. When you, if you go to $12 an hour and everybody in the back of the house is working from 12 to 15, I'm going to have to raise half my employees up $3 an hour, which means the meal price is going to go up, which they're going to get another bump. So the disparity in wages in our industries and those establishments is going to get worse. This doesn't help that situation. It makes it worse. And so if you truly want to have a conversation about how minimum wage workers affect, or minimum wage affects low-wage workers, we have to look at some of the provisions that are in federal law around tip wage, around minor employment, because those are the ones that tend to suffer. And when you look at, I know it was a question, what happens to the restaurant industry? There's a study in here last time the minimum wage went up under the ballot measure that Senator Rosenbaum was referring to. And so it shows you what different restaurants, every restaurant's going to be different. Some of them raise prices, some of them reduce hours. You tend to have fewer restaurant employees per restaurant in the state of Oregon as you do some other places. But even like when you look at the tip jar as an example, if I over half the servers on my floor are making minimum wage and $20 an hour, let's just say to round it up from 18 to 20, okay, if I go to a counter service, I'm going to reduce half those employees off the bat. I'm going to pay the ones that work behind the counter at about $12 an hour, and they're going to make about $3 to $4 an hour out of the tip jar. So I've got half as many of what I call my service level employees, and they're making about $5 an hour less. I mean, that's what happens in our industry. And so there's just different things. If you want to talk about poverty, I just think there's a whole host of issues we should be talking about. If you want to talk about trying to help people on living minimum wage, there's options to do it that happen in over 40 other states. But let's have those discussions. This at a straight $15 increase in the minimum wage, I don't think really helps the people you're trying to help. I truly believe that. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or wait till after Mr. Zielinski goes.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Zielinski.
Thank you. Chair Dimbro, committee members, my name is John Zielinski. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on the impacts that minimum wage increases have on family farming operations. I farm with my brothers just northeast of Salem. We grow pears, apples, peaches, and hazelnuts. I'm also the president of Marion County Farm Bureau. Oregon is known for our quality and abundance of fruits and vegetables. Many of these crops require hand labor, especially during harvest. Labor is our farm's top expense, as it is for most Oregon farms. Oregon is the nation's third largest agricultural employer, with an average wage of $14.09 per hour, according to the U.S. Department of Labor. On our farm, we use hand labor for pruning, thinning, and picking quality produce for both fresh and processed markets that are demanding and competitive. There are no machines to prune, thin, or pick pears, apples, or peaches. There are no machines to do much of the skilled, detailed work that is required in nurseries, strawberry fields, and for other crops. Our farm operates with 14 full-time employees and up to 20 seasonally. We offer 1 week of paid vacation to our help to help our employees during any of the few times each year when there is less work available. We ship our pears to both companies that fresh pack for consumers and to canneries. Both fresh and canned products are shipped throughout the U.S. and even to foreign countries where they must compete with pears grown in California, Washington, or even Chile. During harvest, most of our crops are picked using a piece rate system to pay our employees. Our employees make well above current and even projected minimum wage when picking by the piece rate. I believe that the compression factor will force that piece rate significantly higher. Picking apples and pears is hard work, To retain our employees, we will need to pay wages well above minimum wage. Oops. Making pears and apples from Oregon less competitive than fruit produced in other states and countries. A minimum wage increase would affect our entire payroll by putting pressure on all the wages. Our entire payroll creeps whenever that minimum goes up. Employees in supervisory positions who are now at or above the proposed new minimum would not be satisfied to stay at their current rate. The compression would force a similar percentage of increase to their wages, thus making it more difficult to remain profitable and competitive. Unfortunately, over the past several years, farm prices have remained relatively flat. Generally, farmers are unable to set their own prices and are considered price takers, making it impossible to pass increased cost on to the consumer. Each year, pear growers of the Oregon and Washington and California negotiate with canneries that are located in Washington and California, not in Oregon, to determine the price of canning pears. Currently, Oregon and Washington have similar minimum wages, and California is lower. There are more pears grown in California and Washington than in Oregon. The bargaining position of the Oregon pear grower will be at a severe disadvantage. We are struggling to absorb the cost from Oregon's current annual increases. A new higher minimum wage would make it impossible to be competitive. Oregon farmers compete in a global market. 80% of Oregon's agricultural products are exported out of this state. I need to compete with places that typically have fewer expenses to farm than we do here in Oregon. There are over 200 crops grown in Oregon. If you like the diversity of crops that you see as you drive here to the Capitol or anywhere throughout Oregon, then do not pass a minimum wage bill that will force farmers to grow crops that do not use valued and skilled hand labor to grow them. As I am sure many of you have noticed, there are thousands and thousands of acres of hazelnuts being planted here in the Willamette Valley. Sure, some of what is driving that is current good prices for hazelnuts, but a big factor to many farmers' decision to grow hazelnuts is that one or two people can farm well over 100 acres of hazelnuts. The same acreage in broccoli, apples, strawberries, hops, nursery crops, cucumbers, or one of 100 other crops grown here in the Willamette Valley could take as many as 100 seasonal employees and 5 to 25 year-round employees. So far, most Oregon businesses have been able to absorb the difference between Oregon's current minimum wage and the average minimum wage in 48 states that have a lower minimum wage than Oregon. However, if Oregon has a minimum wage that is 207% of the federal minimum wage, it will change the face of Oregon agriculture. You will see a shift in the crops grown and the downstream effect on all the businesses that support and add value to Oregon's agricultural bounty will be devastating. I love history, and I have read about the economic effects of minimum wage implementation and increases of the past 50 years. They have been beneficial to the economy of the U.S. and historically raised the standard of living for millions of workers. However, these benefits did not come at the benefit of one state over another state. They were implemented across the entire United States. It is hard for me to fathom that there are those who do not see the incredible disadvantage that this will be to Oregon agriculture and any business in Oregon that is exporting products out of our great state. Agriculture needs a level playing field to be competitive with the rest of the nation and internationally. The implementation of a higher minimum wage should be accomplished at the federal level, not by individual states. This session, employers are faced with the potential of paid sick leave and other proposals that will increase our operating expenses. I cannot absorb all these costs and remain viable as a business. I am hoping that one or both of my teenage daughters will take over our orchards someday. I am hoping that the 78th Oregon Legislative Assembly will not make it impossible for them to grow tree fruit or other crops that require more labor than a single tractor driver or equipment operator. Our family is going to be forced to make some difficult decisions in order to cut our expenses if the minimum wage is increased. I hope that it will not mean cutting down pear trees and apple trees and cutting my daughter's future. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mrs. Zielinski. Thank you very much for coming over for this. Colleagues, any questions? I do have one quick question for the two of you, and that is, you know, we heard from a previous, we heard previous testimony about the minimum wage being raised back in the late 80s here, and which was in effect a 40% increase. And the question was, how did businesses absorb that? We're looking at something comparable here. Is that anything either you could speak to?
Well, Chair Jembro, members of the committee, like I said, there's a study in there that we did from University of Oregon. It wasn't that increase, but it was the next increase. And every business is going to handle it differently. Like I said, if you can just pass it on to your consumers, that's going to be everybody's first choice. Obviously, in agriculture, you can't do that. In many, you know, some of the higher-end restaurants in Portland, that is going to be able to be done in some of those. But when you look at the mid to low price restaurants, they just can't do that. So they're everyone's going to take a different tack. They're going to reduce their labor force. They're going to do some increases with a decrease in benefits. You do see two or three chain restaurants as you go around Oregon that are starting to put those little things on your table so you can order that. And that's in anticipation, I think, that they feel that at some point in time they're going to have to cut their server force in half. And so everybody does it differently, but you know, it's if you sign a lease, you're going to try to stay in that lease as long as possible. What I think you've seen in Seattle is, even though that minimum wage hasn't kicked in, there were four people where leases came up. They just kind of looked at it and said, is this really, now it's not just on minimum wage, I'll be the first one to tell you that, but you look at a whole host of costs and say it's probably not worth it. But you're going to see basically a reduction of hours, because remember, most minimum wage workers don't work full time. Most minimum wage workers work 25 hours. Every time there's a drastic minimum wage increase, you see those numbers on average get closer to 20 or they drop down. And so they're going to try to keep people employed. They're going to try to keep their doors open. They're going to try everything they can, but it's going to be a combination between hour cuts and price increases.
Thank you.
My question would be the 40% increase that was in, you said 89. And that was just Oregon or nationally?
That was
in
just
my
Oregon.
Research, just,
yeah,
Oregon.
Was just Oregon.
Okay. I can say that in 1989, the amount of pears that were imported from Chile were much fewer. Chile has become a larger grower of pears, and now they're canning pears and exporting pears. There's also pears grown in South Africa going into the European market that put pressure on U.S.-grown pears. And it's so I can say that the market is different now from what it was back then. And we definitely can't. It's tough enough trying to compete with other states that have lower minimum wage, let alone with foreign countries where they have very low minimum wages.
Great, thank you. Okay, thank you both very much for being here. Colleagues, I think this has been very informative, but we have lots more to come. So, and I look forward to seeing you again. We're going to start up at 6. Our hope is to finish somewhere close to 8 o'clock. I'll just remind you all that last time the Senate outlasted the House, and I expect more of the same. And with that, we are adjourned.